Hi, I'm Bill Arnold with George Fraser.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for checking out this podcast, A Real Recovery. You can hear the show live Sundays at 5 p.m. This, as well as many other podcasts, are available to listen to while you take a walk or do whatever you want to do. The address is myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Help.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to what will soon be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery on Real Recovery. Recovery, we really hope that you can recover from whatever addiction you might be dealing with. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex behind the board tonight. Real Recovery, we are unscripted and unrehearsed, which I guess is a euphemism for we are not prepared. I'm just kidding.
That was real obvious right away.
We don't know what euphemism means.
I don't.
No, I know you don't. Alex, do you know what euphemism means?
Some sort of building? I don't know.
You know, I wish there was another word for euphemism. That joke just went over your head, George. Unbelievable. George, we have a great show tonight. We have in studio tonight, we have the law. We brought the law in tonight. And I know you've got a bootleg copy of Rocky V around your house. So you could technically be taken off in handcuffs tonight.
Could be. Wouldn't be the first time.
You have had experiences with the law, haven't you?
Absolutely.
And you've been put behind bars more than once. I mean, I know
yes. It
was jail time, and it wasn't too long, but you had...
Well, it was for me, maybe not for you, but...
I've never been behind bars, but...
Well, it's early in the game, Billy.
No, it's not, George. I've been in 80 prisons across the country, just for your information.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, thank you. As a volunteer. Every time
but when
a
you hear the door shut behind you, even though you're a volunteer...
It's creepy.
You always want to leave, don't you?
Oh, I can't wait to get out of there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good. I think if a guy's comfortable in there, there's a huge problem. And some people are. We'll probably talk about that tonight.
Yeah. We have Sheriff Matt Bostrom and his wife Cheryl's in the studio tonight. We actually asked him if he could bring his wife along because it's date night. It's date night. So
for them, it is.
No, just for us, George, it's just another Sunday night of Real Recovery.
And he brought the cool car, too.
I know. That is the coolest car.
It is.
Yeah.
Can I take that for a test ride afterwards?
You know, we could focus on some sort of ride-along. Yeah. I'll commit to that.
You sit in the back, though. Yeah. You can't. The locks don't work that well.
That's the whole point of a police car, George.
Oh, okay.
George, here's the contrast in the studio tonight. There's a gentleman here in the studio who does not think he's cool, who actually is, whereas we think we're cool and we're not. There is the contrast in tonight's studio.
Thank you for saying we and not just me.
No, I'd throw myself under the bus on that one.
That was kind of you.
Yeah. George, let's talk about a couple of issues tonight because we're going to talk about law enforcement. We're going to talk about the impact that Matt and Cheryl's ministry has in the work he does. I listened to a great interview with Brian Dozier this week on the station. Did you hear that by any chance?
I did not.
Okay. Alex, did you hear that?
I did not.
Okay. Anyway, the Goose, Ryan Thomas, the Goose, conducted the interview, and Brian Dozier said, I'm a follower of Jesus, and on the side, I play baseball. Mm. And I think that kind of represents a little bit about what our guest is as well. He does law enforcement on the side. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But, George, let's cover Step 10 tonight because that's what we're going to talk about.
Well, Bill, we are on Step 10 tonight. And for those of you that might be new listening to our program, we take one of the 12 steps of recovery every week, and we apply it to our Christian walk. And tonight, Step 10 is we continue to take our personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Here's what we want to do. I want to look at what I'm doing, not just what I'm saying. The book of James talks about hearing the word and then not doing it is like a man who looks in the mirror and then forgets what he looks like. This is a test of are you behaving the way you say you are? If you say you're a Christian, could you prove that by your life? So for someone in recovery from alcohol and drugs, like myself, did I go to my meeting this week? Am I in my Bible study? Did I go to church today? Am I on my knees in prayer? And this is a step to tell us that we're either moving towards God or moving away from Him, Bill. And as you know, when we need to be with God most, we're usually running away because we're ashamed and we're afraid. I know tonight when we talk to the sheriff, we're going to talk about what happens to people when they have that moment of mental clarity. Mine was riding in the back of a car cuffed up that I don't want to do this anymore. And we had a guest on a couple years ago who said, God, please make this stop. Well, we have the power through Jesus to have that happen. So what I want you to do, we believe all Christians are in recovery, because if your life hasn't changed from what you used to be like, you want to look at that. But are you walking the walk? And we want to improve all the time. What has Jesus done for us, and what can we do better?
You don't want to make it sound like a burden, though, do you, George? I mean, step 10 sounds like I have to do this, this, and this, and I got all the stuff that I got to get done. It sounds exhausting.
Well,
where's
the
joy?
That is exactly right. We do want to. So we don't do what we should do, what we need to do, what we have to do. We do what we want to do. And Jesus said in John 10:10, I came to give you life and give it to you abundantly. And what we get to see in step 10 is not only the things that we aren't doing, but what has God done for us? If I actually do want to change your behavior, that's a miracle from God. Before we quit drinking, everybody wants us to quit drinking. We don't want to quit, and all of a sudden, one day we do. Praise God. That's a miracle.
Mm-hmm. George, one of the things I want to ask Sheriff Matt tonight about is the context in which young men who end up in trouble with the law have very little connection either to their father, or they have a very weird misunderstanding of God. I think, because the guys that I work with in recovery, they have a very strange understanding of God. They don't really have a context in which they know him or understand who he is. You can say, well, he's your loving father, and they look at you like, what are you talking about? My father doesn't love me. He abused me. He took off. He wasn't around. So where's my model of loving father? So they don't really have anyone shepherding them through that critical stage of life. So they find shepherds in the neighborhood, maybe a kid who's 2 years older than they are, who might they think is cool. And he's got maybe a little bling going and a little bit of money, and all of a sudden, I want to be like him. And down the road to problems with the law, it all begins.
It does. We want to have an authority that we can trust. The only way you're going to learn about God, Bill, and you talk about this all the time down at the Salvation Army, is to get into the Word. Not what we think God is like. What is God like? Mm-hmm. And we need to get into the Word. We also need to have Christian men in our life that we're accountable to. That's why I go to accountability groups and Bible study. I need to, iron sharpens iron, so one man another. I need to be accountable to guys and say, hey, George, you're getting out of line here, or have you tried this? And we need to be with other community members that are like-minded, and that would be a believer.
And the problem, George, from what I can tell, is our impulses are never going to change, basically. But our responses to the impulses can change.
That is well said.
Well, I mean, I think that your impulses are always going to be what they are. But if you get into the Word and you look at the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. I love the self-control thing. You can have a new response.
Don't.
You can have a new response to the impulse that is going to be inevitable.
Right. I don't believe I get to choose my feelings, but I get to choose what I do with them.
Right.
And we're real big on changing our feelings in this society, and I know I am. And I guess maybe the progress of my recovery is less damaging consequences from what I choose to change my feelings. I can pray, I can work out when I get too angry, too lonely, too tired, too sad, rather than pick up a drink or a drug, okay?
Is that why you work out 16 hours a day?
I cut back today,
okay,
because of the show.
Good.
But you're right.
Saving up all your energy.
Balance is hard for us in our Christianity, too, Bill.
Yeah. Well, George, you know, in 1 Corinthians 10, there's that famous verse that says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. Now, we talk about that verse all the time with people in recovery. But I think we oftentimes leave out is the next verse, 14, that says, therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. And idolatry is oftentimes that God substitute in your life, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever it is that's consuming that area of your life and your heart that you should be placing God in. But we don't flee idolatry. We hang around it because we like it. It's comfortable. We don't have a new response to the impulse that we're having all the time.
How do you flee idolatry?
Well, George, we've talked about this before, playmates and playgrounds. You know, are you with the kind of people that have gotten you in trouble in the past? Are you in the places where you've gotten in trouble in the past? And I think you have to ask yourself, and I need to physically be in another place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't have to change anything. You have to change everything. And the way we do that is we are either all in our walk with Christ, or we're not in.
Mm-hmm.
Half measures avail us nothing. You stand at the turning point, and with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be thorough from the beginning. That's what the early recovery guys talked about. And we're either all in on this, we can't compartmentalize this, that I'll give Jesus this, but I'm going to hold on to this area.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we get in trouble.
Okay, George, so far so good. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we've got three wonderful segments of Bostrom.
So can't wait.
I can't wait either. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Real Recovery. We'll be back in just a minute. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Turn up my microphone there, Alex. We're back. We're back. George, we are back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Speak up, George.
Hi, Bill.
Hey. George, we are in the studio once again trying to overreach our potential. And we have got, like, you can't hear me talk?
No. I can.
You can't hear this unless you're hearing it through the headphones.
If I wasn't in studio, I couldn't hear you.
Yeah, I know, but you point to your
That's
ears.
That's a euphemism, huh?
Yeah, there you go. You don't even know what that word means, George.
Went right by me.
But, George, let's welcome the Bostroms into the studio. We've got Matt and Cheryl here. Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
You know, they met in middle school. How about that for a romance, a love affair?
About 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
And when did you guys first start looking at each other like, yeah, he might be okay?
I'm going to let my wife answer that question. And we'll see. She's
I'll
pretty
tell the truth.
Well, there is a certain truth that she tends to carry it the best.
Well, I knew that I was going to marry Matt someday when I was in eighth grade.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And I brought his school picture with me that said, to a nice kid on the back, to church camp that summer.
Did you really?
And I showed this picture to the girls in my cabin, and I said, I'm going to marry him. And, of course, they laughed at me. And I don't know where those girls are today, but it happened. But I had some work to do because he was dating a friend of mine. And so I'll fast forward into high school. We had our first date when we were sophomores at Johnson High School, and it worked out well because the woman he was seeing before that went to Harding, and those of you who live in the area know that there's a friendly rivalry going on there, and so it worked out great, and but I didn't leave the best impression that first date, and so it wasn't until the end of our junior year that we started dating again, and we've been together ever since.
Now, when your husband goes to work, there's a chance a bullet could fly by his head, which I always find interesting. Georgia, when you go to work, which you actually don't have a job. But,
that's not going to happen.
I mean, the closest you're going to get is some, you know, friend hitting you in the head with a golf club or something, right?
It has happened.
I figure. A
couple times,
right,
yeah.
Right.
That would be scary.
It would be scary. I mean, what is it like as a wife? How do you pray for him every day?
Well, of course, we pray for protection, especially when he was out on the street. Now he jokes that the biggest danger to his life right now is a paper cut. So I'm thankful for those days. But we had our decades of him working the street. And at the time, to be honest, I had family members who had warrants out for their arrest. And it made our family life very difficult. And I won't go into all the details, but we had a situation where my mom wanted to have a Christmas party and invited us, of course, and some of those relatives who had warrants out for their arrest, and it was real difficult for us to come to a place where we could agree that it wasn't the best to bring those people together, especially for a Christmas holiday. I tried to explain that I needed to back up my husband, and out of integrity, if he were to show up, he needed to arrest them. And I invited her to think about it from their perspective. Would they want to see Matt walk through the door on their Christmas Eve? So, you know, things like that that we've had to. Yeah, I guess the answer is no.
Yeah.
But it was difficult. And as Matt was going through the academy, and it was becoming more and more clear that he was going to be chosen as a police officer, I really had some struggles with that because of my family situation. And so I was working through it. Matt was trying to be a good husband and to help me. And one night I was just sobbing in bed. And he's like, what is wrong? And I said, you know, honey, you're going to be a police officer and you're going to be killed, or you're going to have to do something to my family. How are we going to get through this? And Matt said something very interesting. He said, honey, I'm not going to do it. I can't live like this. I cannot move forward if this is what our marriage is going to be. Well, then I completely turned my attitude around because I realized if this is where the Lord is calling Matt to serve, I need to step up and be a supportive wife. So then I started crying for different reasons. he was like, now what am I going to do with her? You know, she's a mess. But I really found a scripture verse that has become my life verse, and it's Proverbs 3, 5, and 6.
Love
to trust in the Lord with all your heart and to not rely on your own understanding, but in all your ways follow him, and he'll direct our paths. And so he's done that, and he's protected Matt. And, you know, people well-intentioned would say to me at work, for example, at the time I was working at 3M, and they would ask me, aren't you afraid that he's not going to come home for supper that night? And, well, yeah, you know, but... So those kind of comments weren't helpful, and so I just want to encourage people to think about police officers, law enforcement, a little bit differently tonight maybe, to see and understand that they're human beings, that they have family struggles just like you do, and that we are going through some emotional trials. You know, families are going through divorce and addiction, and their kids are getting arrested, and thankfully ours haven't been arrested, but we've had other things, you know, and it's not easy, and I really draw upon Dr. Gilmartin's research. He talks about the emotional state of police officers and how if you can picture two lines kind of mid-range, and when an officer puts on their uniform and gets ready for work, they're gearing up, you know, for that big race, and their emotions go way above that line that you and I might normally operate. We have our ups and downs, but it stays within that mid-range. Well, when an officer goes onto the street, they're way above that, and they're operating way up here with the adrenaline. And so as research shows, when you come home, you've got to come down just as far as you were up. Mm. And so what officers might happen with them is they get home, and they're equating those negative feelings when they're coming down with their adrenaline, they're equating those negative feelings to what's happening at home. So Matt did this naturally early in our marriage. He was intentional about our faith and staying involved at church and his personal relationship with the Lord. But also he made sure that we kept friendships with our high school friends and people outside of law enforcement so that we could kind of keep that balance. Otherwise, if you're always talking about what's happening out on the street, it can really skew your attitude about what's going on in our world. So...
George, you realize that our show gets 94% more interesting when we stop talking?
At least.
At least. Oh, those were fantastic comments. Those really, really insightful. I mean, to hear the side of it.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm sure, you know, it's pretty obvious that you're going to be worried. But about coming home, I suppose that's like, Matt, when you pull somebody over after a high-speed chase, and all of a sudden, you know, the guy's really threatening your life. And all of a sudden, okay, I give up now, and you got to... tone that down. That's pretty hard.
Yeah, it does present some challenges, and that is one of the things when we go through our selection process, we have to know is that person capable of operating at that level of hypervigilance, which Cheryl was describing, because that is what you need. You need that in your deputies, your police officers, your correctional folks. They need to be at that hyper level. The issue then is understanding physiologically how the Lord made us, that there's a place on the other side of that. You have to catch that so you don't just fall off the edge. And when I say the edge, literally, it'll just drop off. You leave work and say you're going to leave it at work. It doesn't happen that way. So encouraging folks to make sure that you burn that off either with physical activity or that you have a social system, in particular church, a faith system, are those that do the best. Because for those that don't, people don't realize in law enforcement that there's a it's right around 30% of the men and women in law enforcement are suffering from post-traumatic stress. I mean, think back to the kind of the stories you'd hear about police officers and alcoholism, divorce rate, why it was always so high. Suicide is still the number one killer of law enforcement officers in the United States, like 3-1. Well, does it sound familiar? I mean, when we think about our those that have been serving us in the armed forces, we're attuned to that because that happens in 18 months to 2 years, they come back from the theater and serving overseas, and suddenly they're having difficulty recalibrating. Well, and we call it post-traumatic stress. Well, what we've noticed in law enforcement is the same thing starts to happen, but it's not in a period of 18 months or 2 years. it's over a career. It's okay. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, but then you start to see the same thing.
I wonder if there's a piece, too, about being an adrenaline junkie, mm-hmm. too, that when you you don't have it, you kind of miss it, don't you?
There's a certain piece of that. You can imagine, for folks that haven't been in law enforcement, picture yourself at an amusement park and you're anticipating what it's going to be like. You're getting in line to go on that big roller coaster. What tends to happen as you get closer and closer? Now, I don't know, most of the guys I would hang around with or my wife, the banter starts to pick up. It's like your mind is a little quicker. The jousting back and forth, it's all real positive energy. I will tell you, in law enforcement, in a roll call room, when you're getting ready to go out to the shift, that's what it feels like. And then you go out together as a team. Sometimes you're meeting together at calls. Sometimes you're answering by yourself. But as you start your shift, it is. It's like just getting ready for that roller coaster ride, and it is energizing.
He used an example you and I could tie into an amusement park. That was nice of him.
Yeah,
no euphemisms there, Arnold.
He dubbed it down there a little bit,
yeah.
Right, which is good. So it's like the roller coaster? Is that what you mean? Like the roller coaster?
Well, think about that. So the hard part isn't just being at work. The hard part is 24/7 here.
Yeah, but it's also the interesting thing of coming home, and this applies to everybody that comes home with a whole bunch of stress on their plate. And so they look for relief mechanisms, whether it be a cocktail or something that is less healthy than burning it off with some exercise or taking a walk or doing something. And that can be the start of something very dangerous in terms of a life of, you know, you used to talk about staying connected to the Lord and with your faith and your church and your friends. And, boy, that healthy choices.
Oh, you're a soldier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're on duty every day. You don't go for 2 years and come back. It's a career.
So as sheriff of Ramsey County, and this is a very prestigious role, and
you say that with a straight face.
I couldn't. I need to get a shield up here on this side of the studio. We're interested in hearing about for sure what's being discovered on the streets. What you know, as parents listening up, they're going, oh no, I pray my kids don't get involved in stuff. And well, you know, what's the kind of what should we be looking for? What's some of the things that parents should be particularly concerned about?
Well, one of the things I always ask parents to be tuned into is when you see a significant shift in your child's behavior, or you know, when I say teenager, and don't look for it overnight. You know, don't say, well, you know, at 10 or 11 years old, she was like this, and now at 14, she's like this. Don't just assume it's the teenage years. Take a look at the friends, because the friends oftentimes are a mirror into what your kids are and what they're thinking. They may dress the way you want at home, but when you see the kids that they're hanging around with, that's the reflection that they kind of want to see in themselves. So, and again, any one of the things that I mentioned, I wouldn't try to overemphasize that, but I think they merit some consideration. So, too, has the music changed dramatically? What type of music is it? Is it really that dark, heavy, throbbing type music, or is it the language that's being used just completely inappropriate? And then add to that their time away. What are they doing in their time away, and are they becoming more and more secretive? Instead of being excited about what they're going to be doing tomorrow, and you ask them, how'd your day go, or what are you going to be doing tomorrow, and all of a sudden there isn't a lot of forward-looking, doesn't sound very hopeful. They're not just grousing about the crabby teacher. There's other things where there really seems to be a loss of hope. Those are all things to start to watch. And then the other thing, what can you do at home? Because sometimes kids will start looking for the experiment. And one of the places that we're finding more and more youth experimenting is right in our own medicine cabinets. Most of us, when we go in for some sort of procedure, we follow the directions. The physician says, here's the painkillers to help you recover. And they take only as many as you need. So what happens? Most people never come even close to using that complete prescription. So what they do is you take a couple and you leave the rest because you think it doesn't feel right dumping it down the toilet and it doesn't seem right to throw it in the trash. So in the meantime, you leave it in your cabinet. Well, what would it take at your house if somebody went in and took all but two of those? Would you really remember how many were actually in that morphine-based pain reduction? Or prescription, rather. And so what we're appealing for, and it's to thwart that introductory use. And we're seeing it with our youth because what's happened is where we thought we had completely almost eradicated heroin, there's a resurgence, and you probably have seen some of this on the news. But there's two problems. One is the purity level of the heroin that's on our street today exceeds 90%. I talked to my commander of our violent crimes enforcement team, our narcotics unit, and it's always right around 92% or higher. You can think about the lethality within that. So showing up in our emergency rooms as overdoses or the lethality where they're losing lives, and there's a strange belief it can be used recreationally. So we've traced that back. Where did it start? Oftentimes, and nearly in all cases, it started in a medicine cabinet somewhere. So the appeal that we make to help parents and families is to take those prescriptions, turn them into your local sheriff's department so that we can dispose of them properly. This last year was right around 6,000 pounds of pharmaceuticals that were brought into our to the sheriff's department. And we know that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. So, again, some of the things you can do, but back to watch your kids' behavior, watch what they're wearing, watch what they're listening to, listen to if they're hopeful about the future. And then secondly, guard your medicines, because if it's not them, their friends might sneak in and grab it too.
I remember in ninth grade, and this was back in the 70s, and there was a kid behind me in class right after lunch, and he looked terrible. And I said, "Hey, man, you okay?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm fine." I go, "Did you take something? Did you what? He goes, "Yeah, I took something." I go, "What?" He said, "Valium." And I'd never even heard the word Valium before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it wasn't until years later I sort of traced it back to, it was probably in the medicine cabinet.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And,
that's where it starts.
And boy, was he a train wreck in terms of a drug user and a consistent drug user, and I have no idea what happened to him now. But, you know, it's interesting, back in ninth grade, we were 15, and he was taking Valium.
Yeah, exactly. And people don't realize. They think, well, it's a prescription, so how dangerous can it be? I mean, that's the other part. If it's in your medicine cabinet, that's oftentimes, well, if it can be prescribed, you know, probably okay. They're mistaken.
Well, I think one of the dangers is the gateway drugs. Mm-hmm. Tobacco. It used to be marijuana back in the 70s. It still is for a lot. But a kid can experiment, and kids experiment, and they're doing a heavy-duty opioid. And after a while, there's some physical addiction here. So the next step is heroin. It's on the street. And, gosh, you don't get out of the crime cycle. You know, we see forged prescriptions and people that go in for operations that are upstanding citizens, and they get addicted. It's very powerful, and these drugs are... You like taking them.
Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we have more with Matt and Cheryl Bostrom. You're listening to Real Recovery on Faith Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex W. coming at you with tone and tenacity and maybe a little bit of luck. And we'll take luck over skill any day, won't we, George?
Absolutely.
Because we have in studio Matt and Cheryl Bostrom. Both of them have PhDs, and it makes us feel like kind of not very bright.
Well, we kind of feel that way anyway. This just doesn't help.
Yeah, it's not helping us at all. So... it's just, you know, they met when they were in middle school, and they've been married forever and four kids, and Matt's the Ramsey County Sheriff, and he's got a great job. And, you know, how do you feel, George?
I just think it's a neat story. I like the fact that he wrote on his picture, "To a nice kid." You know, that's romantic, isn't it? Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
To a nice kid. Huh?
Explain. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you autograph it too then?
I'm certain that I put my signature on there. And, you know, at that time, understanding that I was the oldest of two younger brothers, all my cousins were male, with the exception of one that was like my only female cousin out of 10. Was about 7.5, 8 years younger. So the only female that I really understood was my mom and what her role was, and my grandmother. So the idea of these other girls in junior high, really a mystery. And I was very much wrapped up in sports and played in the band. So I had an awareness of the girls, but completely confusing. And so,
I was able to
at least come up with some sort of greeting. And I did what I did with all my, with my friends.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
To a nice kid.
Yeah.
Okay, man, I'm curious about the way your heart must break when you are, through your experience in law enforcement, to see kids who are just off the rails. Where was the dad? Where was the upbringing? I mean, how are these kids where they're at? I mean, they just must lie all the time.
it is challenging in law enforcement. It almost gets to the point where it's refreshing when someone tells you the truth.
I bet.
You know, the proverbial traffic stop when the cop walks up to the window and asks you, do you know why I'm stopping you? Now, I have to admit, I've asked that question 100-plus times
in my
career.
Yeah, I always say it because I didn't see you.
Yeah, and and for a lot of – and you know what? You probably wouldn't have gotten a ticket from me because with most people, if they – it was so refreshing when they'd say, you know what, officer, I rolled that stop sign back there and I probably didn't signal my turn. I would make sure they had their driver's license was up to date and they had insurance and I would let them go.
Wow.
Because it was so rare. Otherwise, if they were completely oblivious to their driving, I had a rule. I'm in a marked car. If you made three mistakes in front of a marked patrol car, there was no way. And it was. I did have a three strikes rule. And I usually was, unless they were particularly crabby, I only tagged them for one. So, but you're right.
Yeah, it's like if I guess wrong, am I going to get two tickets?
Yeah.
I'd like to buy a vowel, please?
Yeah.
I mean, but, I could just see myself trying to negotiate out of a ticket, George.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, back to your question about the kids. It was interesting when I was working in the DARE program. That was really refreshing for me. That gave me a positive side of law enforcement. I'd been in law enforcement for about 7 years at that point, and that put me full-time in the classroom in elementary schools. And I know – so during the school year, you're around these kids, and I saw the hope. And I saw – because the kids that I was arresting, I know not all the kids were in trouble, but all the kids that I saw when I was working patrol were in trouble. And so it does start to affect you after a while. But there were some patterns that we noticed, and that was who ultimately, young adults or juveniles, who are you taking to jail? And in particular, I couldn't remember the last time that I had taken someone to jail that had finished high school.
Wow.
It just that alone was one of the first things you started to see, is that if they hadn't finished high school, or how many people had finished high school that you actually ended up going in being incarcerated for anything. Very, very rare. And then back to as far as how you learn to interact with other people, it became very, very clear that there weren't a lot of men around. And so, you know, one of the side things I ended up doing, coached a lot of sports with our kids and coached a lot of football. And so there's a great, great number of stories there that in that role, I knew that was part of ministry, is to be available for those kids so that they could see that there was physical, make sure physically you're working. Two, there are rules. Three, there's a male around here that is going to hold you accountable, but you're going to get a lot of praise when you do things right, and your team is going to support you when you do things right. And when you're not doing things right, there's a whole lot of accountability. So in that environment, they really learned quickly, and at least in those roles, you started to see a couple males that maybe they weren't seeing it in other places, but that was a way that we could try to take some of that to the community, and there were a few other police officers that joined me in that effort.
It's interesting we're talking about the roles, and in the New Testament, Bill, I think it's in Timothy, 1 or 2 Timothy, about the last days there'll be a lawlessness that people be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, and disrespect their parents, and little things that we see in recovery and addiction is there's no respect for authority, and the little things are broken. I see at the health club people having their kids go in a hot tub. It says you have to be 12 and they're under. And I'm thinking to the kids, how do the kids know what rule they can break, and how do they know what rule they can't break? Do you see this as a societal issue?
I do see it as an issue. And how should I – maybe an example would be going to a restaurant and I'm in uniform and you have a parent – I become the boogeyman, okay? You know, it's like I'm the clean plate police. You know, if the kid's not eating their food or being a little squirrely in their seat, you know, they'll say, you know what? I can hear them across the room say, you better sit down and be quiet or I'm going to have that police officer arrest you.
Serious?
Okay, and Cheryl's heard it. She's been with me at times where that's even happened. Or a kid's being a bit unruly as they're walking through shopping center or something
okay.
like that. The kid's tugging. You've seen that. And I'm going through there in uniform, and you see the parent say the same thing. You better – and I'm like, I just want to appeal to those parents. Please don't do that. If your kid is in trouble, I want them to know I'm out of all the people they don't know in the room, there's one safe place to go. I want that to be a deputy, and I want that to be a police officer.
Mm.
I don't want that to be the boogeyman that Mom pointed out is that's my own purpose in life was to take them to jail. But back to that original question, George, is that I see parents leaving it up to the schools to provide guidance and discipline. And when I say discipline, that's both the positive and the negative side of that. And I say the negative, you know, but where people lose some privileges associated with that. because people have got this entitlement attitude. And, you know, you see it in employment. If you talk to other employers, they're going to see that, that it's not about what they can do for their coworkers and their job or the mission of their organization. It's what is that going to do for me? And I think so on the hiring end of it, you see it. But as parents, they're turning it over to the police, you know, and or they'll or teachers, coaches or other people. And if the kids don't turn out right, they blame the institution as opposed to taking a look in the mirror and saying, you know, I wonder if I contributed to that.
Pretty heavy stuff, Bill. I think there is a problem here. For me in my life, I had a total disregard for authority. And it really starts with the disregard for God. We don't want anybody telling us what to do. There's that defiance. And in our adult life, we talk about all our sins or idolatry. I'm putting myself above God. I know what God wants me to do. And you see that daily. One of the things, because I used to go talk to guys in your jails, was the Christian atmosphere that's there. And how do you do that in a government agency where you really can't push that, but yet it came across that you guys really cared? How do you do that?
Well, I think it is we're expected to be salt and light. What does that look like? And the Lord places us sometimes in vocations that don't require you to be preaching from the pulpit. So there's other ways you're supposed to communicate. Be prepared if someone asks you a direct question. But in the meantime, be the Lord to those folks. And so in my particular facility, I ask our detention staff, and at any given time in Ramsey County, we probably have 400 to 450 people in custody. They're there for an average of 5 days or less. So it moves very, very quickly. So our interaction is brief, but intense. You can imagine everybody coming through that sliding door, that's the worst day of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, there's people that they've done that multiple times. But as you know, George and Bill, I'm sure you've run into these folks that when there's one of those times they're going to come through there, and in their heart of hearts, they're going to say, I don't want to do this anymore. So what I've challenged my staff is to say, certainly the measure of our success in our detention center is, did we keep that person safe? Did they make it to court and get their constitutional rights observed? But secondly, were we attuned enough that did they say something on their way to that cell where they said, I don't want to do this anymore? Because right now we're very blessed at the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department where we have over 90 volunteers, many of them faith-based volunteers or chemical health-based volunteers that have come in to provide an alternative. And then it's up to our staff then to make that handshake, to do that introduction. So when they leave our facility, they don't have to go back to the people that they know doing what they know. There's somebody else that they trust that has put them in contact with somebody that can take them in a different direction. And so that becomes the measure of success. How many people don't come back? And to again, challenge ourselves to get better and better at that each day.
You have an audience, Bill, that's receptive at that point. I think the greatest evangelical tool in our society is the Department of Corrections. I know it helped me get sober. It's either go to prison forever or get sober. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll take what's under, you know, behind door number three. Those aren't good options, either one, really. But you look back and God intervenes, and a lot of us who got sober had to go back and make amends to officers who really saved our lives when we would want to do them great harm. And yet to do that on a daily basis is really a high call, and to do it in an effective way, boy, you're on the front lines.
Well, and you really have to trust that what you're doing is purposeful. And so when you look at the type of men and women that we want to bring into law enforcement is one having that deep sense of purpose. Well, where does true, in my understanding, where true purpose comes from is understanding that it's not all about you, that God created each of us for a specific purpose. And so if you hire men and women that have that level of character and train them to be highly competent, as opposed to what we typically do, we typically hope they have the good experience and hope they have good experience and we can develop a skill set and hope they have character, we've got that flipped on its head. You look for people that have character and purpose in their lives and then shape them and train them into those people that have excellent skills. And so in doing so, a lot of those other things that come from that, their ability to be other-minded, mm-hmm. and to be a good role model, whether they're on the clock or off the clock, when you ask them why do they do what they do, they shrug their shoulders because they don't know how to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes our task. And if I'm going to be effective as sheriff, I've got to continue to refine that ability to find those men and women and then reinforce it, not just hire them for it, but reinforce that throughout their career. And through that, it brings not only balance within your department, but ultimately you become that agency that the citizens of the county expect. But also you can know that you're entrusting some of those people during their most difficult times. They're going to be able to keep their wits about them and not worry about the personal things that get said to them by people that are under extreme circumstances. And then the good news is that you get a chance to hear when some, because we talk about DWI, all my guys, when they go out DWI sweeps, when we're working on those things, it's not about throwing people in jail. We know that we're saving lives.
You bet.
Wow. Love it when you hear it put that way, George. We're going to take a very short break. We have one more segment with the Bostrom. Stay put. You're listening to Real Recovery on Faith Radio. Everybody, glad to have you aboard Real Recovery tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex W. on the board. We have Matt and Cheryl Bostrom in the studio tonight. Matt is the Ramsey County Sheriff, and Cheryl is his wife that they met in middle school and been in love ever since.
You like
so
that.
Nice, yeah.
True. Yeah.
All right, so you've got how many kids, Cheryl?
We have three children.
Three children, and boys, girls?
We have a daughter who's 28, and a son who's 26, and another son who's 24.
Okay, did any of the two boys
give, or take a few months,
any of the two boys give you some trouble? I mean, what's it like when they have their little rebellious years and dad happens to, you know, own a nightstick?
Well, we talk to our children openly about our expectations, of course, for their behavior, but we tried to raise them in a way that they would grow to become followers of Jesus Christ, and they have all three prayed to receive Christ, and so we're thankful for that. One of the things that I think Matt did very, very well, he's done a lot of things well, but one is that he was consistent. So the Matt we saw at home was the same Matt that people see out in the community. And I really mean that. It's what you see is what you get. And so he wasn't a different person when he was in uniform than he was at home. One of the things I tried to do, we weren't perfect at it, but we had a commitment that we would try not to have any arguments or disagreements right before he left for work. And the reason for that is because when he's out there dealing with people in these terrible situations, we didn't want him thinking about me and the argument we had right before he left. So I wanted him to be able to give his full attention on the job and not have to worry about what was happening at home. And when our kids, up until they were about, our youngest was 7 years old, I was a stay-at-home mom full-time and loved that, and I wouldn't have traded those days for anything. So we would hold each other to that. We wouldn't have any arguments before he left for work. The other thing we tried to do is when he came home from work, I didn't want to have him come home through the door and have me tell him, guess what your kids did today, and to talk about some negative things that we had to deal with. So we had a commitment to having some coffee, trained our children that they needed to leave mommy and daddy alone for about 15 minutes, and we would reconnect as husband and wife. We believed that was the most loving thing we could do for our children, was to make sure that our relationship was right. So we have some cute stories of the children trying to interrupt. One time I remember our youngest, Luke, came around the corner. He was maybe 3 years old, and he kept peeking around the corner at us as we were having this time together. And finally, Matt called him over, and he said, Luke, come on over here for a minute. So Luke toddled over, and he said, Luke, is the house on fire? No, Daddy. Luke, is anyone bleeding? No, Daddy. Okay, then you need to go play so that Mommy and Daddy can talk for a few minutes. It was just a precious story that I have, and it speaks to our commitment to being consistent in our walk with the Lord and how we raised our children.
My dad would have said, is anybody bleeding? Well, not yet. Get out of here. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. I've met Matt at work and here in the studio a couple times, and it comes across. What a nice guy. Your staff is the same way. Hard for kids to have dad be a cop?
I think it was a challenge. My dad was a cop.
So I
might know a little bit about that. And so you understand, I think we share something in common with ministers' kids. I grew up with that, where if there's something happened in school, I remember more than once one of my teachers saying, you know, what would your dad say if I called him right now? And never said that to the other kids in class, but said it to me. And at the same time, you know, I thought, well, wait a minute. It shouldn't matter that my dad's a cop. I know why she did it. But then I got to thinking, no, this is, even at a young age, I figured out this isn't okay whether my dad's a cop or not. And so, but knowing those things, that's what, as Cheryl pointed out, we tried to learn from those and say, what does that mean? Kids grow up with enough pressure. And at the same time, I said, you know, we're going to do things here because you're a Bostrom, not because of what my employment is. And Cheryl didn't mention this, but she was terrific with the boys. And she's good, great with all the kids. I mean, exceptional. But one of the things I knew that I learned from my mom is she didn't wait for my dad to get home either. And I knew, although it'd be very difficult to deal with my mom providing her physical remedy to whatever it was my brothers and I had done, that I knew I didn't want to receive that from my dad. So I didn't cause my mom, you know, if I got into trouble, it was a hot stove. She dealt with it. And Cheryl did the exact same thing. And so the boys also learned about my respect for my wife, so that I wanted to model for them. This is what it means to love a woman, and then what a male role was in that. But at the same time, you need to respect your mom. And that was, if they ever got a little bit out of sorts, I would instantly cut over if they said something a little bit terse toward their mom. I stopped it right there. I said, nobody talks to my wife that way. And, you know, I think you could talk to them today, and they're like, okay, wait a minute, I didn't even think about it that way. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This has nothing to do with that. Nobody gets to talk to my wife disrespectfully. But I think as they've grown into young men, I think they understand more fully really what that means, and at least what we were trying to accomplish as a couple as we raised our kids.
That's a very forceful way of saying that. That backed both of us up. Alex is in the other room now.
He's behind the soundproof glass.
Well, they sensed my sincerity.
It came across. Yeah. I hope I haven't offended you in any way, Cheryl, because I didn't intend to. So you're modeling this at home and out there. Bill, it's not about being a cop. It's a ministry job.
Well, George, it ties into step 10. Doesn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, so
you can't do it if you're not doing the work yourself. You have to be in the Word, mm-hmm. both of you. Mm-hmm. You have to be in church. How does your spiritual life work itself out? Can you give us some examples of how you guys do that?
Well, Cheryl, why don't you go ahead and jump in? I know you have she has her early morning routine.
Yes, I have my early morning routine where I'm in the Word, and right now I'm the last couple of years, I've started this process of actually transcribing scripture. So I've started at Genesis, and I am handwriting the entire Bible. And, you know, as you can imagine, I've taken up quite a few notebooks. And the idea is that someday I will turn these over to our children, and they'll have in their mom's handwriting the scriptures. And I highlight specific verses that just jump out to me, things that we're working through in that particular time. And it changes, as you know, when you're in the Word. You read a verse one time, and it's important, but doesn't really speak to you until the next time you're really going through something, and then, you know, you're in the middle of it, and it jumps off the page at you. So
I never heard anybody do that.
George and I are stunned. We did it. Halfway through Genesis 1, we'd be, oh, this is too much work.
Well, I'd take a day off. You know, when you're supposed to rest, I never would pick up the pen again.
That's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard.
Yeah. How far are you?
I'm in the book of Luke right now.
Oh, my gosh. You got through Leviticus. I can't even get through reading that, Billy.
You'd spill grape juice on it about, you know.
Oh, how cool. What a legacy for your kids. Yeah. You can't top that.
So, no, that's why I wanted, you know, I let her go first, and then if you had any time remaining, you know.
Yeah.
But I tend to, as I go through my scripture time each day and to make sure that my prayer time is consistent, I tend to be more of the end of the day kind of guy is where it works. I mean, I do begin the Word with a short devotion, begin the day with a short devotion in the Word, and then complete the day. And I have a tendency to read biographies, particularly Christian-based biographies. And, you know, so at this particular time, I'm going through the Swindoll series on great lives. Mm-hmm. And so, but that tends to be the other one where I can look at what are those great, so in this particular case, what are those great lives? What are those men and women of character that have gone before us? And what can we learn? And what's the Lord calling me to do when I'm in a position of authority?
Mm. We've got about a minute left, Matt. So I'm wondering if you could give a little bit of advice or counsel to the people out there listening who go, you know what, I'm struggling with an addiction, and I get behind the wheel on occasion with the alcohol level above the law. But I've been getting around it so far. Mm-hmm. Any advice?
Well, if I can make an appeal, please don't depend on your own understanding about what your capabilities are. If you are in any way not at full capacity when you get inside a vehicle that is going to weigh anywhere between 4,000 and 6,000 pounds, it becomes a missile. And you think that you can control that missile, but you really can't. And so if in any way you are in a position that's compromised, please, 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 please don't drive that car. And secondarily, call somebody that can help you. And if not, like I said, we're around to even help and give advice in those situations. What a rare thing it would be for a deputy to come alongside somebody and say, can you call me a cab? Because our deputies would. What a gift it would be to have somebody call us and say, I don't want to get in my car. I didn't know who else to call. And we'd love to be able to do that for somebody.
George, we're out of time. I can't believe how fast this hour has gone.
We didn't do another show.
We didn't cover half the questions we wrote. Well, we didn't really write questions, but in theory, had we written questions, we wouldn't have been able to get to half of them.
It's a great show. Let's do it again. We want to reload this sometime.
This is a great show, and thank you so much for being such wonderfully interesting guests, and we hope you enjoyed tonight's episode of Real Recovery. Have a great week, everybody, and hopefully see you next Sunday at 5. Good night, and God bless. Hi, I'm Bill Arnold with George Fraser.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for checking out this podcast of Real Recovery. You can hear the show live Sundays at 5 p.m. This, as well as many other podcasts, are available to listen to while you take a walk or do whatever you want to do. The address is myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening.